Senator Talmadge, there are indications the Watergate Committee's staff has uncovered far more than we've been hearing at the hearing so far. Is what we've heard up to now just the tip of some Watergate iceberg about the manipulation of the election and nomination process?
We will finish the Watergate aspect of it next week, hopefully, probably Wednesday, and then we'll go into the other phases thereafter after the August recess.
From CBS News, Washington, Face the Nation on the CBS Radio Network, a spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with Senator Herman Talmadge, Democrat of Georgia, who is chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee and a member of the Senate's Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities. Senator Talmadge will be questioned by CBS News correspondent Nelson Benton, Martha Angle, Senate reporter for the Washington Star News, and CBS News correspondent George Herman. We shall resume our interview with Senator Talmadge in a moment.
On a sun-parched desert, in a humid, tangled jungle, beneath the stars of a tropical seaport, these are the places that Hopis are found. Hopis, the people of Project Hope, sail to distant ports on a white hospital ship or take up residence in our own Southwest with this common goal, to help others become medically self-sufficient. Project Hope's mission is not treat and run, it's treat and teach. Hopis teach medical skills to professional counterparts who are eager to learn new methods. And they teach willing workers with limited education the skills that help them contribute to the well-being of their own communities. Help Hope live on. Contribute to Project Hope. Room A, Washington, D.C.
Now, once again, here is CBS News correspondent George Herman.
Senator Talmadge, let me see if I can narrow it down a little bit. I think we've all heard, all of us from the Washington Press Corps, have heard reports that your staff on the committee has come up with a great mass of information about other efforts to manipulate the Democratic nomination process, among other things. And what we're curious about is what we've heard so far just a small part, or is it really the main burden of what there is that the committee staff has found out?
Well, there are all kind of rumors going around. The staff may have some information that I don't even know about myself. But this investigation will be divided into three aspects. First, the Watergate aspect, that is, the breaking and entering and the cover-up. We will conclude that, in my judgment, next week, Wednesday or Thursday at the latest. I hope we will. Then, after the August recess, we will go into the other aspects, the so-called dirty tricks and the illegal use of campaign funds. I don't know what information may develop during that period. I'm not privy to all of it myself. But in the hearings, the public will be available. They'll get that information.
Senator, in view of the difficulty that some members of your committee seem to have in agreeing on what has been presented to them so far, in judging the credibility of various witnesses, how are all seven of you ever going to be able to agree upon findings of fact and conclusions for the American people?
No one, of course, is an expert online. The credibility of witnesses will be determined by the American public. I think after the Watergate aspect of it, we perhaps can file an interim report. Some things that we probably can agree on, and other things that we can't. Other things we shouldn't perhaps even file a report on. But in the final analysis, the American people themselves will determine in this matter who's telling the truth and who isn't.
Senator Talmadge, in this, the Watergate aspect, your current witness, Patrick Gray, who started on Friday, who resumes tomorrow, testified before the committee that he told the president that he may be mortally wounded by staff members who are looking out for their own interests. In your opinion, has the president so far in this Watergate phase of the hearing been mortally wounded politically?
Well, of course, all we can tell about that is the various polls that we see. The president's popularity, according to the polls, has gone down from 68% to some 40% at the present time. That's the best measure that we have as to the president's popularity. I wouldn't call that mortally wounded. I would call it a substantial decrease in popularity of the American people. According to my information, the word mortal means death. No, the president's not dead.
Well, Senator, President Nixon ran particularly well in your area of the country, in the South, during the last election. What kind of feedback are you getting from the voters of Georgia in regard to the conduct of your committee hearings and in regard to the voters' perceptions of President Nixon at this point?
My Georgia mail runs substantially like it does nationwide. It's very heavy. It runs a full panorama of American public opinion. Some of those say the president ought to be impeached immediately. Others say that the hearings have proven a great disservice to the country and ought to be suspended instead of. And then there's a wide feeling in between.
Which way is it heaviest?
Oh, I think insofar as my own situation is concerned, even those that want to impeach the president and those that want to stop the hearings have been favorable. Some of my colleagues have had less favorable remarks. The majority of my mail wants the hearings continued.
Senator, you mentioned the word impeached. As you know, Representative Drinan introduced in the House last week a resolution for impeachment.
Yes.
Do you think, sir, that that is premature?
Premature. There's no evidence to date, competent evidence to support it, and public opinion won't support it.
You, when you were appointed to the Senate's Watergate Committee, went reluctantly. You were sort of the reluctant dragon. You didn't want to go. You said you had more pressing business. In fact, you are quoted as having said you thought it would be a waste of time and a bore. Has it been any of those things?
No, I didn't quite say that. As a matter of fact, Majority Leader called me in my office one morning and said, "Herman, will you serve on the Watergate Committee?" I says, "Mike, I already have more burdens than I can carry. I'm chairman of a full committee. I'm chairman of several other important subcommittees." He said, "Herman, will you serve on the Watergate Committee?" I says, "Mike, under those conditions, I have no alternative except to accept." He made me an offer I couldn't refuse. It's been burdensome.
You turned down
the majority leader when he asked you to assume a responsibility in the Senate, particularly one of this magnitude and importance. So I accepted under those conditions. I have tried to do my job. I've found it both interesting, fascinating, and burdensome and boresome at times.
Can you tell us when you have found it boresome?
Well, when you sit there hour after hour under the glare of television cameras day after day, and sometimes the questions get redundant ad infinitum, I find it a little boring.
Okay, now you call it an offer. It sounds more to me like you were pressured by the majority.
No, it wasn't pressure. When the majority leader asked a member of the Senate, particularly of his own party, to undertake some responsibility of tremendous magnitude in the Senate, you don't take it lightly. You assume that burden.
All right. Now, you've assumed that burden. It seems to me, and this is an unofficial poll of one, that when you question, you stick to one small area, usually, and you work on that alone. I don't know whether they're areas of particular interest or whether you think they are areas that have been neglected. But what is your philosophy of questioning that you seem to stick to so small an area?
Well, sometimes it's both. Actually, by the time the senators get to interrogate the witnesses, the lawyers have pretty well milked the subject dry. Now, you can ask redundant questions that the lawyers have already covered, or you can get into some other area of particular interest. I have tried to ask questions that I thought related to some area that had not been covered. I've tried to avoid redundant questions. I've tried to be nonpartisan, objective, and fair without being a prosecutor or defender. And I think most of my mail indicates they support my position.
Senator Talmadge, you cited the polls to me just a few minutes ago. May I cite one to you, sir? Lewis Harris took a poll this past week on the effectiveness of questioning by members of the committee, a poll in which you ranked fifth. I'm sure you saw the poll.
I did.
Would you agree with that assessment, sir?
Everyone has a right to their own opinion. I have a right to mine. I have no objection to anyone taking polls. The only poll I'm interested in is the ballot box in Georgia, really.
Senator, lawyers for your committee are going to court this week to try to enforce the subpoena that you have issued for tapes of President Nixon's conversations with John Dean, and also for White House documents that you've sought unsuccessfully. Do you think the president's been abusing the doctrine of constitutional separation of powers in refusing to make these available to the committee?
My own view is that there is such a thing as separation of powers. The Constitution makes that clear. Under separation of powers, I think there is a doctrine of executive privilege. My view of executive privilege is that we could not subpoena an advisor to the President of the United States, say Dr. Kissinger, have him come before our committee, and have him recite the advice of the papers that he gave the President in international relations, like trips to Pekin, like trips to Moscow. But when it gets into an area where members of his staff have committed crimes and acted to obstruct justice, well, that has no doctrine whatever in executive privilege or separation of powers. It's just a common crime.
Is there, to your way of thinking, a cover-up of the cover-up going on at this moment?
Well, I wouldn't accuse the president of a cover-up of a cover-up. He has a right to his opinion, and I have a right to mine. I voted to subpoena the tapes. He refused. The matter will go to court next week. I hope he'll comply with the court order, and I'm sure our committee will, whatever it is.
Why has he been so slow to come forward to the American people with some explanation of what happened, particularly after June 17th?
Well, you'll have to ask the president that. I can't speak for him.
Senator, on this whole matter of the tapes, the White House has indicated that within a week to 10 days after this first phase of the hearings is concluded, that the president will speak out in some sort of forum or some sort of series of forums. Today, there's a report that the White House may be preparing a white paper. Do you think there is some way that the president can lay the tapes issue to rest through this kind of forum or this kind of series of forums without going to court?
I don't think the tape issue will ever be laid to rest until they're made public. And I think the president's making a great mistake in not making the tapes available to the committee and to the public. If the tapes report what the president and Mr. Haldeman says they report, why, they will lay the cloud of doubt away from the White House immediately. And very little reason for the committee's continuing on the Watergate aspect if that's true. So I think it's in the interest of the president personally, in the interest of the office, in the interest of the economy, and in the interest of the country that he make those tapes available. And I also think that the president needs to go before the American public in some manner that's suitable to him, either before our committee or at a press meeting where he can report his side of this situation and submit himself to examination. Because there is a cloud of doubt hanging over the office of the presidency.
You mean public examination, Senator?
Well,
for example,
200 million people can't interrogate the president, but representatives thereof can, yes.
Well, on television?
Television, some press audience, or committee of the Senate of the United States, we were set up to inquire into this matter. And we have had presidents appear before committees before. On many occasions.
The
last one, I think, was Woodrow Wilson.
I raise the question because Majority Leader Mansfield is quoted today as suggesting perhaps the president should have the full committee in at an informal meeting. And my question is, will this solve anything? Must it not be done in a public forum?
Well, I think if the president invited the committee over to the White House and says, gentlemen, I want you to come over here and visit with me, and then made those tapes available where we could hear them, and if the tape supported the President of the United States, I think the evidence of Mr. Dean would then be quashed, and that's the only real testimony that affects the President and directly implicates him, except General Walters' statement as to Patrick Gray's conversation with the President of the United States the night of July the 6th, 1972. If the Dean testimony and the so-called evidence of General Walters, which was reported to him by Patrick Gray, were demolished, then the President of the United States, insofar as the cover-up is concerned, would be absolutely exonerated.
Supposing, Senator, we followed your scenario. The president were to invite the seven of you to the White House to hear the tapes. And the tape turned out to be exactly as the president has characterized them. He thinks they exonerate him, but he says that somebody else listening to them might feel that they did not exonerate him. And the committee divided, say, 4-3 on whether the tapes did or did not exonerate him. Where would we be then?
That would still leave an area of doubt in the minds of the American public. But I think those seven members of that committee are fair-minded men, and I think if there was any area of doubt, they would probably resolve it in favor of the President of the United States. But if the tapes indicated that Dean was telling the truth, I think that committee would so report.
Senator, do you think that John Dean's testimony taken as a whole has been refuted by subsequent witnesses, particularly Mr. Haldeman and Mr. Ehrlichman?
Well, we've had so much conflict in testimony up there until it's difficult to say who refutes whom. I will say this. You know, Mr. Dean read a 245-page statement. Took him 6 hours to read it. And then submitted to vigorous cross-examination there for 4 consecutive days. Not only by the counsel for the committee, but also the members of that committee. And there was no great contradiction of any of that evidence in 4 days' time. He was a remarkable witness, either the greatest liar since Ananias, else there was some element of truth in what he said.
Which?
Won't you have to make this determination at the end of these hearings?
I don't know that you can. How do you decide who's lying and who isn't?
Isn't that your duty as a member of the committee?
Not necessarily. When you say you don't know who's lying and submit that as a report, I presume that would be adequate.
You said at one point early in this interview that there might be other things that you would find out or that you might happen upon which perhaps you should not even file a report about. What did you mean?
I didn't say we wouldn't file a report. I said we would look into other areas subsequent to the August recess, the so-called Dirty Tricks Department that's been much in the media, and the illegal use of campaign funds and things of that nature. Now, I hope we can expedite those hearings after the August recess, and at that point, there won't be so much public interest. We might be able to create 2 subcommittees, one to look into the dirty tricks aspect, and the other the illegal use of money. I do hope that we can complete this investigation at the earliest possible date, submit our report, and prepare such legislation as may be warranted.
Well, I find in my notes, and perhaps if you'll correct me, that you said that there were various things you might file a report on this and that, and there might be other things on which you should not even file a report. Perhaps you meant simply that it would not be necessary.
Well, it would depend on what evidence of the entire hearing warranted. You don't file a report on the state of the weather in Phoenix, Arizona. You file a report on something that the committee's uncovered that needs legislation to correct.
Senator, on the matter of subcommittees of the Select Committee itself, it was a report Friday that you will head a subcommittee to look into allegations that Carmine Bellino, the committee's chief investigator, was engaged in some sort of electronic surveillance of Richard Nixon in 1960, charges that he has denied. Is this correct? And if
yes,
so, what will that inquiry...
I have been informed by a copy of a letter from the chairman. He appointed myself, Senator Norway, and Senator Gurney. Now, the resolution, as you know, directs this committee to look into illegal campaign activities of the 1972 election. The charges are filed by 3 affidavits been submitted and the chairman of the Republican National Committee charges Mr. Bellino with bugging President Nixon's candidacy in 1960. That would be outside the purview of our committee's jurisdiction. But I do think what we need to look into, and we will, is the evidence that's been submitted, because if it's true, Mr. Bellino ought not to be retained on the committee staff. We'll look into that aspect of it.
How long do you expect that investigation to take, Senator?
Well, I don't think it'll take very long. There's been 3 affidavits filed. One of the people that filed the affidavit is now deceased. The others have already been contradicted in some respects. Well, I think we need to look into it because it reflects on the competence of Mr. Bellino to serve on the staff of that committee.
There's been some question raised in recent days at the White House and elsewhere, I believe, in the media about the fairness of your committee and charges that you are showing more and more partisanship. Do you think this is true?
I think this has probably been the least partisan committee of the United States Senate since I've been in this body. It was created by a unanimous vote of the Senate, every Republican and every Democrat. The committee is organized on nonpartisan lines with a Democratic chairman and a Republican vice chairman. The committee has worked cooperatively in the extreme. We have rarely had any votes where there was any dissent at all.
You did have
one.
And
only had one vote where the Republicans voted one way and the Democrats another. Not all the Republicans voted at that time.
That was in regard to calling Mr. Colson as a witness at this time. Why did the Democrats oppose this? He's one of the president's
supporters. Because we had already passed a resolution designating which witnesses we would call. Prior to the time, Mr. Scott sent us a letter asking us to call Colson at this particular phase. We looked into the evidence, and we found out the evidence against Mr. Colson related to the so-called dirty tricks operation and not to what he knew about the Watergate aspect. He will be called. He will have an opportunity to be heard.
Senator, Mr. Colson's name has come up just very frequently in the testimony of many of your witnesses on the Watergate phase. His name has come up in connection with the Watergate phase of the hearings. Isn't the committee running a risk of leaving a rather extensive gap in its Watergate record with an interim period coming up?
When Mr. Colson comes before the committee, if he has any contributions on Watergate, you may rest assured it'll be explored at that time.
Senator, one of the things that you have been doing while you've been trying to investigate the Watergate is managing an agriculture bill. Now, I don't want to get into the details of that because I think that would take us a two-hour program to get into. But what I want to know is, from your point of view, from your vantage point, is America, is the world going to be food short, food poor? Are we from now on going to have to give more and more of our income and our energy to food rather than to the other things that we've been occupied with in life?
We're food short right now. That was the reason we drafted a totally new agricultural program. We'll put 50 million acres more land in production in the United States next year to produce more food and fiber, not only for the American people, but for the world also. One of the reasons food is so high now is because there's a worldwide shortage of protein. The people are enjoying a high standard of living than any time in the history of mankind. The demand for food is high, not only in this country, but all over the world, and they bid prices up because of the shortage.
Are we going to be able to, simply by changing the agriculture program, get enough food and fiber produced in the United States to help the whole world and to bring us back to where we were before, or is it going to be a new world?
We certainly hope so, but of course you have to have the cooperation of the weather and rain and a lot of other things to produce an adequate supply of food. I think we'll have the largest wheat crop in the history of the country. We'll have the largest feed grain crop in the history of the country. When you have large crops of feed grains, it necessarily follows you'll have more abundant poultry, swine, livestock. When we have adequate supplies, then food will go down. It won't until that time.
Assuming that we don't sell a great deal of it for our foreign exchange program to other countries and leave us again in short supply.
Well, of course, the tremendous sale to the Soviet Union last year also had much to do with driving up the cost of food and grains, as you know.
Well, what I'm trying to get to is, when you balance out all these factors, what is my wife going to have to do when she goes to the supermarket next year at this time? Is it going to be just as bad or worse?
Hopefully not. It depends on the abundant harvest that we might get this year. If we get the production that we're aiming at, I think food prices will be cheaper next year. We have shortages right now.
Down from where they are now?
Yes, in my judgment.
Senator, may I get to the short range of that? You voted, I believe, with most of the Senate this week to a sense of the Senate resolution to urge the president to lift the freeze on beef prices before September 12th as scheduled. What would lifting the freeze do now? What is it going to do to beef prices when it does come up?
It all goes back to phase 3.5, when the prices of some farm commodities were frozen below the cost of production. What was the result? They started selling gilts for pork rather than keeping them for breeding purposes. They started killing chickens because they couldn't produce eggs at the prices that was set. That created a shortage. And now they've had the same thing kept on beef. What's happening? farmers are holding their beef off the market. They're shipping them to Canada where they can get higher prices. People that operate the food chains are calling me, telling me there'll be a shortage of beef. You see, slaughtering plants closing down all the time. The only way we can reduce food prices is an abundant supply and let the law of supply and demand take effect. When you start trying to artificially control it, you'll merely curtail production and create black markets. That's been the history historically, World War II, the Korean War, and phase 3.5. We've got to correct it.
So, Senator, it was the Democrats who back a year or so ago were pressuring the president to impose a freeze on prices and wages of all commodities. Do you think that the original freeze, phase one, was a mistake?
Well, if you're going to have a freeze, it must necessarily be completely across the board, and then that's a temporary expedient at most. You can't change the law of supply and demand.
Well, where did
by
we go wrong?
Edict. We went wrong by excessive spending of federal funds for 37 out of the past 43 years. The inflationary spiral that we've been in, trying to act as banker and Santa Claus and policeman for the whole world for more than 3 decades now, trying to do for people overseas that we won't do for ourselves here at home, trying to feed and clothe the world all at one time and protect them with our troops, and it was beyond our capacity to do so.
Well, here we are right now in fiscal 1974. Are we going to hold down to a balanced budget, or are the little exceptions being made here and there in supplemental appropriations going to ride us over and increase the inflationary pressures?
My colleagues vote as I do. We'll have a balanced budget. Yeah. I can't speak for anyone but Herman Talmadge.
Now, sir, I've never met a Southern senator of long experience who is not an expert counter of noses. What do you think?
I think you have a greater degree of fiscal restraint in the Congress of the United States at the present time than I've seen since I've been in this body. We've made recommendations about how to control our budgetary expenditures through the Congress by setting a ceiling and reviewing that ceiling. And then if that ceiling is exceeded, the tax writing committees of the Congress must bring in a report to increase taxes to pay for it. If they will adopt the report that we've made available to the Congress, we'll bring some fiscal restraint to this government.
Well, which are we going to have, a hold down on spending or an increase in taxes or neither?
I would prefer a hold down in spending.
Well, I'm asking you to crystal ball it. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, that's speculative. I don't
yes,
know
sir.
That they'll adopt this report, but if they do, it'll have great restraint on the spending programs of the government of the United States. Now, I can say this. This has been going on through Republican and Democratic administrations alike, the chief executive and the Congress. None of us without blame. There's enough blame to go around for everyone. But correction is long overdue.
All right, we have about 30 seconds left, and I guess what I'd like to really ask you is, how does it feel all of a sudden to be Herman Talmadge, a member of the Watergate Committee, and sort of the darling of the liberal Democrats all of a sudden?
Well, I hope I'm the darling of everybody everywhere. That's what all politicians like to be, but I particularly hope I'm still the darling of the people of Georgia.
Do you think that this exposure of important Southern and Democratic and Republican Southerners on the Watergate Committee has helped the image of the South in the country?
Oh, I don't know. Obviously, Sam Irwin and Ed Gurney are two of the most able men in the Senate. I'm
Senator
delighted that they're members. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Talmadge, for being with us on Face the Nation.
Even if someone served them a slice of beef, they couldn't bite into it. Their teeth are too weak. I'm not talking about some people off in Africa or Asia. I'm talking about Americans. American children. It's really tragic how many thousands of them there are in this country whose teeth will literally rot because they'll never receive basic dental care. They may not even own a toothbrush. What hurts is that it takes so little for any one of us to help them. The same dollar, for instance, that buys you 2 packs of cigarettes can buy 3 American children the first toothbrushes they've ever owned. I'm Eli Wallach. Won't you give up some cigarettes so some American children can have their first toothbrushes? Send your dollar to Americans for Children's Relief, Box 5050, Stamford, Connecticut. That's Box 5050, Stamford, Connecticut. $1. Oh, and of course, if you can afford more, give more.
Today on Face the Nation,
Senator Herman Talmadge, Democrat of Georgia, was interviewed by CBS News correspondent Nelson Benton. Martha Angle, Senate reporter for the Washington Star News, and CBS News correspondent George Herman. Next week, another prominent figure in the news will face the nation. Today's broadcast was recorded earlier in Washington and was produced by Sylvia Westerman and Prentice Childs. Robert Vitarelli was the director. Face the Nation is a production of CBS News.
You are tuned to FM 102, WBEN-FM in Buffalo.